Welcome, everyone, to the Perceptive Podcast. I am Josh Beiser, and we have a great cast for you tonight. Joining me as co-host, artist for Smugbee Games and Game Wisdom site designer, Kenneth Olm.
Hey there.
And our guest this week, she is the co-founder of the indie studio Robot Loves Kitty. Please welcome to the cast, Alex Stolzer.
Ahoy!
Hi, Alex. It's great to have you.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Yep. Hopefully things are not too crazy as this is the big holiday week that we're recording.
Oh, it's crazy, but it's good. Crazy is good.
Of course. This is going to be that big time. We got the game sales once again coming back. And as we're recording, there's, of course, the big Steam winter / holiday sale that is taking everyone's hard-earned money as we're talking.
But it's awesome.
Yeah.
Cheap games is good. Well, for people buying games.
Yeah.
Really.
All right. So to get started with, for people who may not have heard of Robot Loves Kitty, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what your studio is about?
Oh, sure. Robot Loves Kitty is a husband and wife team, basically. We started about 8 years ago, and it sort of came about because we both are avid gamers, but we had really different tastes in games, and so we didn't really have much we could play together, and that's kind of where everything started. And every single game that we have is sort of geared towards things that we would both enjoy.
Okay. That's and for people who are looking into your studio, right now, do you just have the one game out, Legend of Dungeon?
Legend of Dungeon is our first game that we've launched on Steam, but we previously have actually a littler, it's like a kind of a fun game called Tiny Plumbers,
okay.
Which is a online Mario-like with rogue elements. So that's procedurally generated, randomized, editable platformer, I guess.
Okay.
And a few other like game jam games. We just did the Ludum Dare or Dare this past weekend, I think it was. It's just recently. So we have lots of little free games too on our website.
Cool. And you're, of course, working on a new game called Upsilon Circuit, which we're going to talk about probably in a few minutes. That sounds very interesting.
Oh, yes.
All right. To get started talking about your games, could you tell us a little bit more about Legend of Dungeon?
Sure. Legend of Dungeon is a randomly generated action RPG that's heavily inspired by me playing the classic rogue game as a little girl, as well as my husband playing lots of like arcade style beat 'em ups. So like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles comes to mind, and things like that. And so we kind of merged them together, and we used this really interesting visual technique that's kind of, at least at the very start of when we started making Legend of Dungeon, it was sort of unheard of, where we have these two-dimensional sprites that are being lit as if they're in three dimensions. So we can do really fun things like take your character and throw it in complete darkness, and any light that comes about just lights up the appropriate portion of the character.
Neat.
And it's, you know, a dungeon diver, so you dive down the dungeon and you die. Lots of that, lots of death.
Yeah, and looking at the game, the Pixar looks really great. Did you do the Pixar yourself?
I did like 90% of the pixel art for the game. Some of the character design was actually inspired by a person on Reddit, of all places. they had some character design, and we credited them actually inside the starting tavern. They're in there as a thank you. but yeah, I did a lot of that, and the three-dimensional portions, because it's kind of 2.5D. Mm-hmm. Those are all done by Calvin.
Cool.
Who's my husband, the other half of Robot Loves Kitty.
Yeah, good pixel art, I think, is somewhat of an underrated talent, because I think a lot of people, when they think of pixel art, they think of, you know, like the old school, like 8-bit, or maybe even like earlier than that, art style. But over the last few years, we've seen a lot of games go for very high quality pixel art. And one game that I saw this year that went that route was Gods Will Be Watching. Have you seen that game?
I have. I haven't had the chance to play it, but I have definitely seen it, yeah.
And it's quite interesting about that level of detail that you can get into pixel art. And really, it goes back to a lot of great art aesthetics when you can have that, you know, unified look and style to your game.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of the amazing things about pixel art is that it's actually incredibly challenging because depending on the resolution, especially, a single pixel can change everything. It can really affect the look and feel of all kinds of different aspects of the piece that you're working on. So it's So it does take skill, which is something that a lot of people are kind of like, oh, pixel art, I could do that. But there's definitely some art direction that has to happen, and a lot of thought has to go into every little piece, which
Yeah,
is kind of cool.
I think good pixel art too. I mean, you have to stand out, because there's so many people that do choose to do pixel art, and it's usually based on just their budget. They don't really have time to create certain types of art, and they always like jump to 8-bit, or it's like a nostalgia thing why they go into 8-bit. So what you said earlier, Josh, about it being detailed or unique or an interesting take on it is what kind of sets it aside. In fact, could even, heighten it in terms of its uniqueness.
A little bit more history as far as where we came from before we formed the studio. Calvin was a 3D art hobbyist before doing any of the programming on this stuff. He like his arts made it to the front page of oh great, I can't remember the name of the site anymore. New not Newgrounds, that's video games. Never mind, I don't know what I'm talking about. DeviantArt, that's what it's called. So he was actually a 3D artist prior to making any games. And so it was definitely a choice that we did the pixel art as opposed to like just budget type things.
Yep, and that's a really good point. You can really see the difference in a game that dedicates art as a choice versus having to do it for budgetary constraints. And we've seen a lot of great examples from the indie community in 2014 of developers really exploring really great art aesthetics. A great example that we both love is from Clay Entertainment and what they did with Don't Starve and Mark of the Ninja. Especially Don't Starve, it had like that very, like almost like a storybook and like one of those old German fairy tale storybook feels to it.
Yeah, I love the art for Don't Starve. It's beautiful too. So, and it's good colors, like it's very bleak, but still it fits the game very well. And that's always a challenge.
And that is, it's a good thing that you said that, because that's one of the big challenges that we see from a lot of developers is trying to create a style that fits the game. And I was just posting something last week, pretty much on that topic, where we see with a lot of AAA developers who go for graphics over aesthetics, and you have games that look really good, but they don't really look memorable. My examples were, of course, Call of Duty and how it's, browns and grays in most of those games. And that same week, I played Legend of Zelda Wind Waker, the high definition version, for the first time. And, like, I literally just, like, sat in my room and went, holy crap, that's what it looks like now? That's amazing.
I mean, at the time, people really hated Wind Waker. I loved it when it came out. But, like, they didn't like the style. I thought it was kiddish, but it stands the test of time, even now.
That is one of the things that you have to really admire Nintendo about is their art direction and the aesthetics that they use are just they last forever. They're beautiful.
And I feel like the Wind Waker one too, the Link in Wind Waker was the most emotive of all the Links.
Look at those faces he made were great.
And that's another great point, Alex, regarding Nintendo's style. And this is something that we can probably spend like the next hour or two talking about, just in terms of the fact that Nintendo never strives for photorealism. They go for aesthetic and style. And it really does keep their games looking, I guess, relevant or looking well done, even 5, 10 years later. When I spoke with the developers behind Shovel Knight, which was essentially a trying to make an 8-bit game in 2014, they basically spent a lot of time emulating that style, and it looks pretty much like something someone made 20 years ago. And even though those graphics may not be cutting edge today, that unified look really helps it stand out, and most importantly, it makes it recognizable. So when someone sees a screenshot, they know instinctively, yes, that's Shovel Knight. Or when they see Mario or Zelda or Metroid or whatever, they know automatically, yes, that is Nintendo.
Yeah, it's very true.
You have to admire their mascots, like including Shovel Knight. Like a big part of when you develop a character is silhouettes, and if you saw a silhouette of each of those characters, you'd easily recognize them.
That's true. Yeah, they did a wonderful job. I've had the pleasure of meeting, I think, the whole team that worked on Shovel Knight, and they're all just really smart, good people. So that always helps, I think. They put a lot of thought into what they're doing.
Yeah, I spoke to them on the cast earlier this year, I think two of them, and it was just great talking to them about the challenges of trying to make a retro game today while, copying what worked back then. and avoiding a lot of the crazy difficulty spikes in design limitations, you know, stuff like Ghosts and Goblins, the extreme difficulty of like the old Mega Man games, stuff like that.
Right.
Now, getting back to Legend of Dungeon, one thing I'm curious about regarding the pixel art itself, how long does it normally take you to essentially create one of these characters?
Well, because of the special lighting technique, I actually technically have to make twice the amount of art assets for it. I need to create the color, mm-hmm. and then I need to create the depth for it so that the 3D lighting can actually react properly. I'm making bump maps that turn into normal mapping inside the game. And it's done in Unity, which probably makes that process a little simpler. I'm just myself starting to learn to program, so I'm not exactly the go-to for the technical level of that type of thing. But depending on the assets, it can take maybe a half hour to an hour per like item. But characters, creating a character from scratch is a fairly time-intensive thing because of the animations, even though they're simple. Mm-hmm. Depending on it, probably a couple hours for that as well. It's we're lucky because it is a very simplistic art style. It's very minimalistic, so that makes it a little more simple.
Yeah, but I think as we were saying a few minutes ago, just because pixel art may appear simplistic, it can also be very complex. I think your example regarding, you know, just changing one pixel can affect, you know, the entire look of an object or a character.
I have firsthand experience with that because of the heads for the characters. When we started making Legend of Dungeon, we ran a Kickstarter for it, and we had a kind of a classic rogue character, which is just, there's just one person, there's no classes. That was something that was kind of more in the stretch goals, which is actually what we're working on right now, is adding in the classes. And during that process, I had to redo all of the sprites that I'd worked on so far because the hair was off by one pixel. And if I shifted it properly, so it would look okay, it was just a nightmare. But a single pixel gave me like days worth of work just because it was not in the right place.
Cool. Now, another thing about Legend of Dungeon, this will take us into our next topic, is that you guys went to Kickstarter for it. Now, was the Kickstarter for Legend of Dungeon to get the game developed, or did that come to add more features to Legend of Dungeon?
We had been working on Legend of Dungeon for about a month when we ran the Kickstarter. So it was definitely please fund us. We need to make this game. It was kind of an act of desperation on some level because the 2 years prior to that, all right, this is also going right back to the dawn of Robot Loves Kitty. The company started with Calvin wanting to quit his IT job to make an MMO in a year by himself, which is no small feat. Mm-hmm. And it took 5 years for him to make, and we ended up choosing not to release it, which was very stressful and difficult. And at that point, we had to decide, do we keep making games? And do I keep, like, because I was working in order to support us the whole time. Do I keep mm-hmm. working a normal, boring person job and let Calvin do this, or is it my turn? Do I not have to work, and can I help make the games a little more? And so we sold our house and built a treehouse in the woods, and we had that for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And we had no money the whole time, and we were on food stamps. Like, we were, like, scraping the bottom of the barrel. We were very close to homeless the whole time. And it was an adventure, and it was awesome. I could talk about that for hours as well. Like, I saw a porcupine while I was making breakfast once. It's pretty cool. But we were at this point where we were, basically, it was either Legend of Dungeon isn't going to happen because our computers were crashing and dying and blue screen of deathing. Calvin's laptop was actually held together by bolts because he had used it so much. And so we ran a Kickstarter for $5,000 in hopes of just getting new equipment so we could keep making Legend of Dungeon. Mm-hmm. And this is back in, actually, almost exactly 2 years ago. Almost exactly 2 years ago, we ran it, and we ended up getting funded over 600%, which let us actually live in a normal people place, which was amazing. and that's kind of, the Kickstarter changed our lives in that sense. We would still be in a treehouse. And if the Kickstarter had failed, we would have had to abandon making games, and we may never have come back to it. So the fact that Legend of Dungeon is out, we're making updates for it, and we're starting a new game, it's just really all thanks to the people who backed us on Kickstarter.
Cool. And as we're... Oh, go ahead.
I was a question. Do you still own the treehouse?
So we have a friend who builds giant robots in the woods.
That's a great conversation starter. Right there.
And he happens to do it on the mountain in Vermont where we built our treehouse. Because he was like, hey, why don't you just do it on my property so you don't have to spend any money doing anything. And I already have the infrastructure set up so that you have like drinkable water right nearby. And so we were like, yes, that sounds good. The thing that really sold us is that he's on top of a mountain, but you could get internet through your phone from the specific tip of the mountain. Otherwise, we wouldn't have gone. You know, we're not like tree huggers. We're just like, we need internet. Mm-hmm. Can't go without internet.
Of course.
But it was his property. And since then, he has actually sold it. He's now building his own boat in Panama. So he's off on a new adventure.
Nice.
This is opening my eyes to Vermont, by the way. These are all things all these stories sound like something that would happen in Portland or like, you know, the West Coast. I'm glad us East Coasters can be just as weird.
Oh, yeah.
Strange. Because everyone always thinks of us as boring and factories.
Aw, no, we can do tree houses.
Yeah, we can be weird. Take that, yeah. West Coast. Yeah.
Nice. Now, with Legend of Dungeon, you said that you started the Kickstarter after about 1 month of working on the game.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any like special considerations or planning that you guys did to get the Kickstarter up and running?
Kickstarter was in a very different place then than it is right now.
Yeah.
And I don't know that we would have had as successful of a Kickstarter had we done what we did then. The Greenlight process had just recently come out, and we chose to launch the game on Greenlight to try to get Legend of Dungeon greenlit, which it did. It got greenlit later, which was amazing. And then a week later, we were starting our Kickstarter for it. And there was very little preparation that we did for it. Our video, I mean, it's still up. You can go to our Kickstarter page and you can watch us both standing there awkwardly in front of a chalkboard where we had drawn in chalk our game, Robot Loves Kitty logo. And it was just like about a week's worth of preparation. And we were not ready. I can't imagine the amount of stress that people go through now, like the months of preparation that you have. And then during the entire Kickstarter process, it's also just chaos and stress. So,
yeah, definitely. I mean, you're not the only developer to say that. Whenever we have developers on to Kickstarters, they've shared their own horror stories. We just spoke with Ron Gilbert and Gary Winnick, who did Thimbleweed Park, and they're just talking about the insanity running Kickstarter. And for a lot of traditional developers, those who started in either the AA or AAA industry, who then made the move to indie, it's really like a completely different beast, especially
yeah.
for people who are used to, you know, publishers and getting your funding that way. Now you're dealing with your fan base, essentially, who are funding your game.
Which I think is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's absolutely incredible. And I'm so glad that Kickstarter does it. And I also think that the added like skepticism and fear that has kind of come about from a lot of failed Kickstarters and things like that,
mm-hmm.
I actually think that that's a wonderful and good thing, because it's feedback for the person making the game. If the game doesn't get kickstarted, it's probably a good idea to actually look through your game from a new perspective and make sure that you're doing what you want to do and that it's okay, you know? So it's valuable feedback at the very least.
Yeah. And with the sort of decline of like that gold rush period of Kickstarter, consumers have definitely got a lot more inspective of new Kickstarter projects. And this is another thing that we've spoke to developers about over 2014. As you said, Alex, in 2012, back when, you know, Double Fine posted there and sort of blew up this whole idea, a lot of people really rushed to that platform and games were pretty much getting funded left and right.
Yeah.
And today, it's definitely a lot different. We spoke with the Darkest Dungeon developer, Red Hook Games, earlier this year, and they said they basically spent 6 months of planning just to get the Kickstarter working, because they felt they needed that in today's market compared to in 2012.
Mm, yeah, no, it's definitely a very different thing, and it's kind of... It adds to the stress from the independent developer side of things, because suddenly you're investing mm-hmm. a little more time, effort, emotion, and money, probably, to your Kickstarter campaign, which is not guaranteed to succeed. So there's this, It's a very interesting dynamic, and it's definitely something that is shifting constantly. So I'm really curious to see where Kickstarter ends up in the next few years for game development stuff.
Yep, definitely. Now, we spoke on the cast before that we basically Ken and I share different opinions on. He's a lot more optimistic than I am of it. And it's kind of interesting when we spoke to other developers about, because we're getting that same mix as well. We've spoken to some developers who say that they will not use Kickstarter unless it's, you know, their absolute last resort. And then we have developers who say that, you know, they love it so much it's going to be their main model from this point forward.
I think it really depends on your own personal approach and what you're using Kickstarter for. I keep debating whether or not we should go to Kickstarter for our new game for Upsilon Circuit because I feel like the interaction that we got to have with our players and the way that they got to shape the game with us was just amazing. It was such an awesome experience, and I would love to have that again. It's just a question of whether or not it's appropriate for what we're doing and all that jazz. But I think it's a wonderful way to have people who care about what you're doing care more, and you get to care about them, and it's kind of neat.
Yeah, I
That's
mean,
my opinion.
the way I see it is, well, Kickstarter is more of like a charity service to me. Like, these are people with great ideas, and you want to support and make that dream come true. You're on a journey together, you know, to make this thing actually possible. And there's a lot of people that are pessimistic. Actually, I had a conversation with, you know, like an investor and some finance guy, and they're having about how the Kickstarter is like the worst thing ever, and like it's like the worst investment someone could make because you don't actually get any actual return. And it's better if there were people to donate money, they should, or not donate money, to actually invest, they should, you know, go into some sort of stocks and go into small businesses and all that stuff. I'm like, but that's not really, to me, it's different realms. It's not really an investment as it is, you know, helping someone achieve their dream.
It's not an investment, it's a participation. It's a, yeah, you get to kind of make something possible for people, even if it is potato salad.
Yeah, and they made it, yeah, they made it sound like super negative, like such downers of these guys, because again, they said it's not a viable model and it shouldn't be used and should be done away with. I'm like, why? It is a new way to fund projects, and we can't just rely on like venture capitalists and angel investors and corporate sponsorship for the only way to get projects off the ground, or selling everything you own. So
Yeah,
I think it's go
oh, go
on,
ahead.
sorry.
Sorry.
No, I was gonna say yeah, there's other viable means, but go on.
I was just going to say that one of the things that a lot of people overlook as far as Kickstarter is concerned, compared to getting investors of some sort, is that there is a massive level of freedom that you get with being able to actually control what you're making. A lot of times with various different publishers, and this is changing. There's more and more publishers creating more friendly terms, but a lot of the times, like there's the possibility that you go to a publisher. This is with more than just video games, but since that's what I do, it's kind of the angle that this is going to go in. But you go to a publisher with your game idea, and they say yes, let's do this, and they sign an agreement. And oftentimes it used to be that, and it still is, that you actually basically have signed up to not have your game published if they pull funding. They can actually say, you know what, this is the end. We're not going to publish this, and you can never ever publish this game that you were working on. It's a extremely common thing to have happen. There are so many more games that don't reach completion than people realize. And that's actually something that Kickstarter is showing as well. A lot of the failed Kickstarters, or not failed Kickstarters, but the successful Kickstarters that fail to deliver. That's just how video games work. Sometimes the team collapses. Sometimes there's some sort of horrible unforeseen issue with the engine you're using, or who knows what. And games don't always get made. But having it in the hands of a publisher means that you definitely have less control.
But now you're at the mercy of thousands and thousands of people at the same time, and then you feel a different kind of pressure. But
Yeah, that's true.
I would say it's an understanding pressure though. Like if you have problems, you know, they'll a little more lenient than these guys. They'll give you a hard deadline, and then if not, they'll pull your funding, you're screwed. But for these guys, they've already kind of threw in their lot with you. And you know, sometimes I see some pretty negative comments here and there. Like I was looking at what's the Consortium, a backpack Kickstarter, mostly because they're going to say they're going to give Oculus Rift support, and they didn't, but they will soon, hopefully. I mean, they decided to do Mac priority. I'm like, why Mac? Who cares about Macs? Bleh. But they had
seriously,
Mac.
I could talk about Macs for hours. Sorry.
But so Oculus Rift support. But there was someone made like the most like heinous, awful comments on their Kickstarter page. Just like I was checking out this morning, and it was just saying like how like they're the face of Kickstarter failures, and I'm like, they delivered a game. It seems pretty good. I don't really see the problem. But this guy, I guess he has some sort of like insane standards. But by being so negative, he just kind of brings that kind of fun train to a halt. It just thinks that you're always gonna have people like that, and sometimes some people just can't take that. So I wonder how that's actually affecting, you know, developers, because you're so tied with your audience. When you have that one sourpuss, you're just like, man, what am I doing with my life?
It can be very frustrating to get negative feedback from people. But I think as far as our experience with Kickstarter goes, we ended up totally not hitting our delivery date, but we tried our best to give everybody something. So we had originally, we were like, yeah, this will be done in like a couple months, was what we thought. But then because the Kickstarter did so well, we just felt like we had to reflect that in the game. We wanted to make the game better because of it, and it just ended up taking longer. So what we did is, like, at the delivery date, we're like, all right, everybody's in the beta. We can play what we have so far, which is about where it would have been otherwise. Some people liked that, some people didn't, but nobody was really outwardly angry with us over at that point. I feel like to some extent there is a level of entitlement that happens with not just Kickstarters, but like people buying games in general. and that's something that's probably never going to go away. And that's you just have to deal with it, and you have to build a thick skin.
Oh, right. Yeah. Definitely. Because, man, their demands can be insane. I mean, look at this whole 60 frames per second thing. I mean, I think it is very important, but like it's become its own movement, 60 frames per second for all games, which in my case, the reason I support it is just because for Oculus Rift, you want to have like 72 frames per second as like a minimum for your game. Yeah,
because otherwise you will feel sick.
Yes.
Yeah.
And for them to trend to make everything 30 frames per second because of pretty much to match whatever PC and console to be tied in the same level of quality, that difference. I think that's a really insane notion to hunker down PC or wave PC down because of console. What's the term for it, Josh? You used it before.
What was it? Consoleitis? Console heavy?
No, there's a term for it when you hold back PC, the potential graphics, etc., to make it match consoles.
Can't think of it off the top of my head.
Dang it, you used it in an article, Josh.
No, I can't think of it right now.
It's okay, but that's what I'm saying. Like that kind of sucks. But it's saying like, but again, not all these movements are reasonable either. So you kind of had to pick your battles. Especially what I see is at least Kickstarter and smaller projects is sometimes they aren't really careful with what they say, right? On their public forums, these developers, and then they get some horrendous feedback. Not everyone's meant to be a public figure, you know?
That is one of the challenges of being an independent studio. When you're really small, you are your studio. And it's tricky sometimes because you do have these emotions. And if you just wear them out on, like, what is it, wearing your emotions out on your sleeve? Is that the term?
Right. Yep.
That's going to get you in trouble if those emotions aren't all good. That's something that we've learned actually really quickly. Luckily, we didn't make any mistakes. We just saw people's responses to things and we just really thought hard about how to do it. And we've actually turned a few people who were really angry into fans just through being decent, reasonable, nice people, which is good, I think.
Yeah,
definitely. I mean, sometimes it's just wording that does it to people. They read way too much into a sentence. Be like, does it mean this? How dare you? And they become like this. You get all these like huge things in the comments. You're like, oh no, I have to say something to correct this. But if you do anything more, you might make it worse.
Right.
So sometimes people, I think some devs need some PR training to a degree, or have someone do their PR. It helps a lot.
Yep.
Yep. And we see this with a lot of indie developers who aren't really necessarily the best to be public faces. The recent example, the Paranormal Activity developers, who just made like almost every mistake in the book.
Oh, yeah, I'm not going to say anything about that.
And you really do need to be very careful with how you speak to your fan base. I mean, a lot of people don't seem to understand the concept that when you're posting something online, it's not a private discussion. It will get out. I mean, the whole thing with, you know, him wanting to kill Gabe Newell, that should never be said on, like, a Twitter or Facebook or anything like that. And a lot of people assume that these online sites are, you know, like your own living room, but you really can't treat it that way.
A lot of the way that people talk on the internet is as if they were just having a conversation with their close friend. Like in a room with like three people you know really well, you can sling around death threats because everybody knows you and they know you're not serious. But on the internet, there's no way of gauging that. So there's definitely something you have to be careful of.
It can be taken out of context too easy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, plus it's in bad taste. That's just a joke in bad taste.
Mm-hmm.
To begin with.
And again, 140 characters on Twitter is not enough to make, you know, witty remarks and jokes. And, you know, a lot of people seem to fall into that trap. We talk, you know, a lot of times about, you know, Phil Fish and his meltdown due to these types of issues. And, you know, it really is a shame when developers essentially, you know, cut themselves at the kneecaps when they can't handle, you know, the public face that well.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've heard a lot of people be like, oh, I don't want to pull a Phil Fish. Like, there's this, he's become a term. He is in a sense, a verb at this point.
True.
And I think it's something that everybody has to deal with because you can't make a game that everybody will like. That I'm pretty sure is impossible because people are so diverse and that there's bound to be somebody writing you at some point saying something negative about something that you care about. And that's just something you have to deal with. And oftentimes you should just ignore it. And that's something that a lot of people aren't capable of doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where some of that issue comes in, I think.
Yep.
Pride. Definitely. It's probably the big part of it. You know, just too much pride will get you in the end.
Yep.
And for Phil Fish, I mean, like, to me, this is something that's new I kind of factor in when I purchase games, is I factor in the developer, who they are, what they've done in the past, how they acted. And listen, if that developer is a big douche, I definitely don't want to support them. You know, if there's someone that obviously conflicts with my views or has done something atrocious, there's no, like, I don't care how great the game is. They're not getting that purchase. And listen, I know that Fez is, like, award-winning and great and beautiful and all that jazz. I'm still not gonna get it. I still don't want to support him. So that's my own viewpoint. And hey, there's a lot of times when I met developers or be interviewed, and I immediately backed their Kickstarters or, you know, bought their games because of they had such a wonderful discussion.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing occasional like these big live stream events where I'll reach out to a lot of different indie developers, and so far I think 99% of the devs that I have talked to have been absolutely amazing and smart people. I think that something about the independent developer scene actually really, you only see the people who are like, they're just, everybody who's doing it loves what they're doing and it's important to them. And that kind of brings about a certain type of personality.
Yeah. I think, and everyone has a really interesting story. Like, your story is probably one of the most indie stories I've ever heard. It's amazing. Like, that's definitely like book worthy. You should start working on that. I'd kickstart that book.
Oh gosh. I don't know what I would call it.
Living in a treehouse.
Living in a treehouse.
Living in a treehouse in the technical age.
I think you make a really good point, Alex, about, you know, the general attitude and mindset. A lot of indie developers, that's really great talking to them. And that's one thing that we've definitely seen over the podcast these last 2 years, of being able to speak to these developers and really get a chance to pick their brains about their thoughts on design and the industry itself. And we've had, you know, some fantastic discussions. I mean, hell, some of our podcasts have ran to like 2-3 hours long when we get on a lot of great topics. And it's really great to be able to talk to developers like this. And you really can't do this if you're trying to talk to like a major studio, like a AAA studio, because, you know, you have to deal with like a PR agency. And even then, you're still going to be limited what you can and can't talk about. But with indie studios, when it's only like two people, five man teams, etc., you can talk to someone and pretty much get their thoughts on any number of great topics.
It's true. It's true, because you're really dealing with the people who are the game. So it's a little different. Because it's, of course, if you were going to interview somebody at a AAA studio, there aren't that many people who would really be qualified to talk about the entire project, because they would only be involved in a small piece of it.
Yep.
So exactly. there is a reason, to some extent at least, for having some sort of a PR person do the talking. Although it's very impersonal and it's kind of a shame.
I don't know. Well, sometimes PR people can be pretty personable if you get That's to know true. Them and start sending the emails out. It depends. It's always bad when it's robotic. Or the worst is when we do it, is when they just don't respond at all. Not even decline. They just ignore.
Yeah, I've got tragic. A few of those.
That happens on our end too, you know. We send out things, like indie devs send out things to press or people, and just nothing comes back 90% of the time. It's a tough world out there.
Yep.
But, you know, one thing I noticed, and I'm glad that Josh has followed up when we first started the site, is, you know, just try. Some people just love to talk. I mean, who knows who's going to respond? But eventually, you know, you'll get your own following and you'll get some great people, and you never know what kind of discussion you'll have.
But
you got to try. Like, look at you. I mean, I can use you for like so many discussions now. I'm going to bring up your story about Treehouse. And it's like they lost everything. They built a treehouse and they lived in it and they made a successful Kickstarter, and look at them now.
Mm-hmm. When students
complain, they'll be like, man, I can't do this. I'm like, yeah, you can. I know someone lived in it, you know, and I'll just tell the whole story.
Dude, yeah, our running water was literally Calvin running down the hill to get a bucket of water and then running back up.
That sounds amazing. At least in terms of the drama in the event. But yeah, I should restructure one of my classes around your story.
Oh, gosh.
All right. Before we wrap up talking about Kickstarter and crowdfunding, I also want to ask your thoughts on getting Legend of Dungeon greenlit on Steam. And what were some of the challenges and thoughts on that model?
Well, Steam Greenlight had launched, I think it was October of that year. And we put Legend of Dungeon up about a month and a half later, I think. And there was this initial burst of people who were interested and who were looking at it, and then it kind of died down. And I know a lot of people complain about Greenlight, but one of the things that they don't realize is that from a PR perspective, at the very least, it gives you a reason to talk about your game more. You're actively trying to do something, and you have a place you can send people that where they can help you for free. It's an amazing conversation that you can have. And as soon as you're greenlit, you don't have it anymore. And so I'm like, when we got greenlit, it was still when they were releasing games in batches of 10, I think, or 20. I think we were the first batch of 20. Mm-hmm. And it felt like we had won an award. It was just amazing, because it is a struggle. It had been quite an ordeal, very time consuming, but very worth it. We made, like I said, I think 600% was our stretch goal, or like that's how far we went on Kickstarter. And then after that, the sales from not having the game on Steam but elsewhere added up to maybe double that, which was awesome, because that let us keep going. But then as soon as we actually launched the game on Steam, it was just jaw-dropping. The difference, the amount of money that we were able to make because it was on Steam, it was just amazing. And I don't care what people say about Greenlight not being perfect. It is definitely flawed, but it gives you a reason to talk about your game. It gives people a reason to check it out and to help, which is an awesome feeling. And all in all, it gives you the opportunity to maybe get your game on to Steam, which is an amazing distribution platform.
Yep, definitely. And Steam has really done so much for indie game development over the last, let's say, maybe five or six years of, you know, introducing a lot of people to developers and titles that they wouldn't have necessarily seen otherwise. Yeah. And with Greenlight, and even what we're seeing now with Early Access, it is giving developers a chance to put their name out there a lot more. Now, there are, of course, people who are generally concerned that Steam has become a bit too much of a monopoly. in terms of, as you said, it's really a Steam or nothing for a lot of developers in terms of that recognition and really the discoverability of being on, you know, this major platform.
Yeah, it is a bit of a monopoly. But at the same time, I kind of feel like if you're on Steam, you're in good hands as well. They don't exploit you. They don't do anything that feels evil, I guess, mm-hmm. is the way to express it. They are actively trying to improve their system. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate that just as a developer. They're trying to give everybody a little bit of exposure, even though they have very limited exposure. And they're just trying to give everybody a little more control over things as well, which is really cool, actually, because they don't have to do that.
Yeah.
And they are.
Yeah. And the negative thing with, obviously, said about Greenlight, I mean, before the system was even worse, right? Like, they've picked at random who was allowed to come in. So Greenlight, there's some sort of way for you to directly affect the games that go on to at least the next rounds, which is great. I mean, you said, like, it is flawed, but they're making progress. And every day they're trying to make the system better and better. So we'll see where it goes.
Yep, and that is definitely the good thing about Steam and Valve in general, is that they don't necessarily rest on their laurels. If there is a problem, they will generally try to figure out a solution to it or a workaround. And there's been talk over the last year that they're thinking about, I think, removing Greenlight and replacing it with something else, or they may change it. I think that's been the news.
They're looking to change up how they do it because something. I don't quite know what. Mm-hmm. They've shifted Greenlight itself to such an extent that I'm not really sure if they're just planning on shifting it even more or discontinuing it and doing something else.
What are your thoughts on Early Access, which is Steam's other system for developers to showcase their games earlier now?
I think it has potential, and I think it is being abused. Mm-hmm. Those are my two initial thoughts as far as Early Access goes. I think that people with the right intention can make use of it an amazing amount, because the level of feedback that you get as a small company, especially, the feedback and the free playtesters, basically, or actually they're paying to playtest your game, which is amazing. But it's really invaluable because it really actually lets you make a better product. But at the same time, then you kind of also reach this sort of the same issue that a lot of people have with Kickstarter, which is that there's really no guarantee that the game will ever actually release, or that it'll be anything like what they're saying it will be during early access.
Yeah, and
so there's a risk.
And the part you said about the free playtesters is a really good benefit. One of the examples would be the developer Gaslamp Games, who are making Clockwork Empires. And they've, you know, talked a lot about all the changes and all the feedback they've gotten from the early access crowd that has helped and improved the game. And that is not just, you know, limited to early access. The importance of being able to play test your product and get it in front of your consumer is very important for developers who are going for either a niche experience or something that hasn't been done before. Because you never know how your game's going to be viewed by the consumer. You know, you just have your eyes and what you've done. But when you're the person who put the whole thing together, your experience is somewhat tainted by that knowledge.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I always think of my mother's recipes whenever I think about things like that, because nobody can understand them but her. And it really is, it's something that you don't realize. But when you're looking at something that you've worked on, all of your experience up to that point is affecting how you see it. So that's definitely the case. It's actually something that we're doing with these. We're currently adding player classes and pets and some other things, including VR support for Legend of Dungeon.
We are
using Steam's beta access. We have like an open access beta going on for Legend of Dungeon for feedback, because we want to make sure it works. We want to make sure that it's balanced and that people like the changes and all of those things, and that it works in the Rift, you know, the DK1 and DK2, et cetera.
I don't know if you really need to support the DK1. I think people's moved on. Well, I guess you should, because there's a bunch of people with DK1 that don't have the DK2. But I should say progress, not, you know.
Yes, right. Yes, moving forward is definitely the way we want to go with it. but which is actually, it's you're gonna have to try Legend of Dungeon with an Oculus, because it's really cool. It's kind of like looking into those like middle school projects that are done in shoeboxes.
Panoramas.
Panoramas.
You know what I mean? Dioramas.
Diorama. That's the one. There we go. Yes, with like a little cotton ball kind of things, except it's all these little 2D sprites in this 3D space, and you can kind of look around and peek at things, because it's with the DK2, you can really see
everything. I really want you to do this, because it sets a good precedent for other indies to do something like that. Because I mean, Dota, for example, Dota 2, they did a spectate mode with VR. And people are discussing using it with possibly League of Legends. I'm like, that would be amazing to like swoop around and see what's going on live in 3D. That sounds like something that I would love, like the new age of esports and a new way to interact with these games. So yeah, definitely. So that sounds like a great idea. I would love to see how you implement it. Keep me posted.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. All right. One last question regarding Kickstarter, and then we'll move on to our next topic. And this is a question that I like to ask all our developers on. I think you've sort of answered already, but I just want to get your final thoughts on it. And that is regarding Kickstarters and generally crowdfunding's how viable it is for the future of game development. This is one of those topics, again, that we've had developers on with different opinions on the matter. Some feel that it will remain viable for development. Others say that it will have to be altered in order to remain a sustainable model. So for you, Alex, and Robot Loves Kitty, what do you think about Kickstarter and its sustainability?
I think that it's probably going to shift as time goes on, just because it's going to have to. But I think it's also very viable, at least for the next 5-10 years, because even though people have to increase, what it is anytime anything becomes popular, more than just 10 people join in and try to do the thing. And so you end up with this massive pile that you have to sort through to find something that you're interested in. And so that kind of does shift the process a little bit, because discoverability becomes more and more of an issue. And that's something that you see with Steam Greenlight as well. That's just the way that something becoming more popular does. Where there used to be, 100 games on Greenlight, there's like 500-600 at a time now. So it's very difficult to be seen. And so you have to be exceptional. And I think that's good. I think being exceptional is something that you should do. And it's what we are aiming to do with our next game, and we'll try to do with our next game, and our next game, etc. Because if you're not bringing something new and amazing into the realm of video games, it's not going to be worth as many people's time. And being worth people's time is valuable to me, at least. I like making people happy and feeling worthy to them.
I think that's a really good point. It's time, because I think now people are getting overloaded of games, and really what the developers are doing is buying people's time, or developing people's time, because there's only so many games you can focus on before you get, overwhelmed, and which is why a lot of people have staple games that they go to, and they have like these other small games as incursions.
The Steam sales and like bundles are something that are actually, I think, affecting the future of video games more so than Kickstarter ever will, because suddenly you have these people who are like 500-600 games in their Steam library, or how can anybody play that many games? You can't. I only have, I think, 60 games on my Steam library, and I played half of them.
You don't even want to know how many games I have on my Steam list right now.
I'll have the tech. 404 for me.
Nice.
I definitely beat you there.
Dang it. No,
there's people who have something like 800 plus games.
I have more cards than you, though.
Yeah, you have that. But yeah, you make a really good point, Alex, regarding game sales and just this overall devaluation of the game market. This is something that I've talked about a lot in the past. We're definitely seeing the full scope of this on the mobile market at the moment, with consumers trained to either buy games through in-app purchases or to maybe spend, 5 cents or a dollar. Any more than that, and they, get up in arms about it, such as the Monument Valley example. And the problem is that free-to-play or in-app purchases is not valid for a lot of different genres, like games that are strictly linear or focused on storytelling, or even the strategy genre is another great example of that, and how those games can really, you know, divvy themselves up to be sold piece by piece.
Yeah.
And if the rest of the market adopts, you know, the mobile style of devaluing games, that could easily put a lot of studios, both, you know, casual, indie, and even AAA developers out of the market.
It's an interesting issue. And the other interesting thing that's coming about is that not only are the values of games kind of being kind of thrown up in the air, but it's also there's here's an example. As I know these devs, they made a game called Shochimi, which is a little fish shoot 'em up kind of thing for the PC, and they decided to ask a dollar for it just because they're like, this is just a small little game, you know, it's we don't want to charge people $5 for it just because it's our first game. And because they only asked for a dollar, people thought, like, almost immediately, they're like, oh, it's only a dollar, it can't be that good. Even though it's an amazing little game, it's just not massive. And so they're right now, I think, actually, they're working on creating a newer version, like adding a little bit more content, some cool new zones and stuff. And they're going to ask a little more money for it because people immediately wrote it off because it wasn't expensive.
Yeah, and that's just very weird when you say that, Alex, because we have, like, mobile developers, you know, if they dare to charge more than a dollar, they have people, you know, down their throats yelling at them.
Yeah.
And then with the PC, it's weird how the PC generally wants to attach a higher value to things to a certain extent. We've been talking about this a while, and I think in terms of PC game pricing, an indie developer will usually charge on average maybe $15 to $20 for their game. And then any more than that is generally viewed unfavorably, such as Prison Architect. I think Banish was high up there, and even something like Gone Home, which I think retailed for $20 or $24 when it first came out. When you start getting over $20, a lot of PC gamers, you know, get annoyed or offended by that. But then on the flip side, if you go too cheap, and as you say, Alex, then they view it immediately as, you know, it's crap. You know, why should I even give it a dollar? It must obviously be a crappy game.
Right.
And then, go ahead.
I was going to say, I was really upset by that so many people wrote off Gone Home because it was too expensive. Like, that was the biggest thing I read in all the reviews. That's too expensive. I'm like, no. Like, this is something new. This is something fresh. This is, like, exploratory storytelling. I love it. Like, it's probably one of my best games of that year. People really just wrote it off and called it horrible because it was such a short period of time for such a large amount of money in their eyes.
That's actually, I know we're trying to get out of, like, the Kickstarter topic shortly here, but that's one of the other interesting things about Kickstarter is that the amount of money that it actually takes to make a game for most teams is far more than you can generally ask for on Kickstarter, because unless you are, for Calvin and I, we were living in a treehouse. We didn't need more than $5,000. But for a team of, like, an artist, two programmers, and, like, a web developer slash artist, like, four people, if they're all living under different houses or different roofs, if they're living separately, that's four survivals for the period of time that the game has to be made for. So, like, if your rent is $500 a pop, there's $2,000 a month just for those four people to live. And that's not even including food, you know? And so very quickly, the price just zips up, especially when you think about the fact that generally, like, a programmer makes 70 to, like, 100 and something thousand dollars a year if you get hired by a company. So to have to ask for very little, because otherwise you won't get funded on Kickstarter.
And don't forget, there's a lot of I know some people that Kickstarter that had infighting with their own groups because they thought they were going to get a certain cut. And obviously you can't have that kind of, like, if you Kickstarter really made, like, I don't know, like $50,000 and you're asking for $45,000 out of a four-person team, then you're completely out of whack. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't make any sense because you go into it knowing the cut and then you should, you know, take that sacrifice. And for you, because with the treehouse thing again, you're used to living on that line into the most extreme line. So you're understanding of that, but some people just aren't adjusted to it and they don't understand you have to make sacrifices if you can do a Kickstarter. Because a lot of these games only ask for about $30,000, and that's poverty level for one person for a year.
Yeah.
And if you have a team,
Exactly. And one great example of a studio asking for the actual amounts that they need and not getting it because it just seems like too much is Dino Run 2. I think Dino Run 2. There was a Dino Run, which was an amazing game. They released it for free, made by Pixel Jam, people who made Potato Man Seeks the Truth. And they ran a Kickstarter, and they asked for actually what they needed, which was over $100,000. And they did not get it. They got less than if they would have asked for $30,000, which is just bizarre.
I think it's got to have, like, there's three things, and I don't keep repeating myself, but there's three things that I see that makes a Kickstarter successful. One, it's an old IP. Two, it has a celebrity behind it, or, like, a very successful or previous developer. Or, you know, zombies. So those threes will make you successful on Kickstarter. So when normal people, without any of those requirements, ask for $100,000, people just like dismiss it unless it's picked up by a lot of different like sites.
Right.
You know, if they create, if they're able to create that buzz, maybe they can actually do that.
Yep, and it's definitely really hard, like, as we said earlier about Kickstarter, that getting your name out there today is a lot more harder work than it was 2 years ago. And part of that problem is that there's so many people going to Kickstarter as a platform and as a funding solution for their game that it's hard to sift through all the different developers that are coming out. And another thing is that people have, you know, limits on how much they can donate to games. Like if someone gives one developer $500, they're not necessarily going to give $500 to their next Kickstarter project.
Yeah. Yep. It's very true. Yeah. And in a lot of ways, it's tricky because with Kickstarter, you kind of have to go big or go home in the sense that if you don't have some sort of really amazing project, you have to either have some sort of celebrity backing you, and even then that's not guaranteed, or zombies, etc. Which is actually, we took a lot of those kinds of thoughts into account when we started working on Upsilon Circuit, because we realized that if we made something kind of run-of-the-mill, it wasn't going to be interesting for us to make, and it wasn't going to be as interesting for other people to understand and talk about and hopefully spread the word, etc. And that's a lot of what you have to rely on is word of mouth at this point.
Definitely.
I guess because it feeds into that problem of visibility. Like that's the big part too, is time, people's time, and visibility for your projects. But another reason why PR is it's very important, you know, like you need to make some sort of plan, not just make a product. Because a lot of people go into or start a game development company looking to make just a great game. But at the end, there's no way for them to market that great product because they're so focused on developing the game.
Yeah.
And I agree. Yep, go ahead, Ken.
But I also don't agree with gigantic companies paying more money for marketing than development of the game itself. Like,
oh, gosh.
I think like games like Fuse and those games like need to stop focus grouping and stop doing other marketing and start focusing on development. Like, there's a certain level. But for indies, definitely, I think marketing is a bigger problem.
Definitely. And I agree with you with that, Ken. We talked about this previously on the cast and how a lot of developers will basically hold up in their studio or treehouse and work on a game for like 2-3 years, and then they will not contact anyone. They will not post any updates. They will not, you know, alert the press at all about the game. And as you said, Ken, they could make an amazing video game, but if no one knows what it is or even that it's out, they're not going to make any money on it. And we're seeing a lot more the importance of good PR and just good relationships that developers will have to leverage with journalists and with communities in general. And I think this goes back to what you were saying earlier, Alex, regarding how great it was to be on Kickstarter and interacting with your fan base on that manner. And that was something that you would never see in a traditional AAA studio.
Right.
But you were able to make that connection with your community, who are then able to basically be your own press junket. They were able to tell their friends who told their friends and etc. And that was able to get your game a lot more notoriety compared to a developer who would just, you know, maybe post an update once every 6 months saying, we're working on art. The game is coming out soon and etc.
Silence kills.
It is honestly one of the most difficult things about our new project, even though it is like Upsilon Circuit is this really awesome thing and I can't tell you anything about it, kind of because of
this,
the gauge that we're trying to reach, this thing that we're doing, we just can't. It drives
look
me
at that
nuts.
Marketing. She's already creating a buzz right now.
There you go. That's right.
Awesome. There's an awesome
thing.
Here's
this amazing game. You don't know anything about it.
It'll blow your mind. It's something brand new. It's something never seen before about the humankind. Come on. Come on. Just come and see the thing behind the curtain.
Yep. And I also just want to bring up as an example of what Ken was saying with developers spending way too much money on advertising. I did a little look at that game, Game of War, the one with Kate Upton commercial. And apparently developers spent about $40 million just to have her in the commercial.
Holy cow.
She costs $40 million?
That's what they said according to one website.
That's ridiculous because actors only get paid like $1 million for like a whole movie. There's no way they pay her $40 million to show up. Maybe $4 million.
It could have been the commercial for itself.
The commercial itself probably costs $40 million, maybe.
Yeah.
No, but that's even then. That's pretty.
A Craigslist ad out. Be like, hey, I need someone in this video.
It sounds too expensive, actually.
Yeah.
I don't know. It sounds too inflated. I don't know about those numbers. Yeah. I think they.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I'm gonna say they probably spent $2 million on the commercial and the $38 million on Coke. That's probably what happened.
There's also you have to pay to have your ad placed as well.
Yeah, it was placed on Thursday Night Football. And whenever you try to get like primetime advertising like that, it costs a lot of money. I think didn't they report that the Super Bowl is like $1 million like a second or something for a Super Bowl commercial?
Yeah, well that's a Super Bowl. And if you look at those commercials, they know and they try to maximize. That's why there's people who don't even care about the Super Bowl. They go and they look for the commercials afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, maybe you saw Clash of Clans and how successful they were and they wanted to replicate that. Because I was like looking at them like, look, oh, it's a clone. Oh, they're doing exactly the same thing. Oh, they're wasting all that money. Okay.
Yep, and part of the problem we talked with the developer Untamed last week about it was the fact that a lot of indie and smaller developers are trying to compete with, you know, King or Clash of Clans, and even though they may try to make a better game, there's no way they can come anywhere to match the advertising dollars being thrown. And that's what's really keeping these studios in the limelight. I mean, we see commercials for, you know, whatever the next Candy Crush Saga game is. There's the constant commercials for Clash of Clans, Game of War is an example. And these are things that the general public are seeing, and that's going to make them more inclined to play that as opposed to any of the umpteenth clones that are trying to copy the game's success.
Yeah, no, it's very true. It's one of the challenges is getting your game seen. It's at least 50% of your success. The first 50% is have a great game. And then the second 50% is have great marketing, or at least have some marketing.
Yeah.
Definitely important.
Mm-hmm. And as you said a few minutes ago, Alex, you know, just how amazing it was to get Legend of Dungeon on Steam. Mm-hmm. And, like, Steam has really helped so many developers with discoverability because everything is consolidated into one store. And that's been one of the major benefits of the platform is that, you know, we don't need to search for patches. We don't need to use three different programs for, you know, copy protection or in-game multiplayer when Steam really can handle all that and be that middleman. And so it really just adds so much value. And that's what makes it really hard to complain about Steam as monopoly because, yes, they are number one, but they're number one for a reason. They've done almost everything right. And, I mean, we could spend the next hour talking about the problems with Origin and Uplay.
Oh, God dang. Oh, yes. I was trying to get cards from, Far Cry?
Mm-hmm.
And dang it, I had to load in Uplay, and I was like, I had to, like, create another account, log in, and forget the password, and then it's like double DRM, triple DRM, and like I couldn't play Tropico 4 for a while because of that DRM.
And you have to log into Facebook too for it, I think, for like God some dang. Other features.
It's an awful thing. Awful.
Yeah. All right. Before we get to our final topic, I just wanted to see, Ken, if you had any questions for Alex regarding the Oculus Rift and VR, since they said they were implementing it into Legend of Dungeon.
I wanted to actually discuss your experience with the Game Jam with VR, because a lot of different types of VR Game Jams going on, and one of them was actually done with the Leap, which is really cool, which is a 3D camera, which like kind of detects your hands. Like
we have one.
Like, I've been. But did you try Waitlist, by the way? It's amazing.
I haven't. No,
Cool. It's very relaxing.
There's some really relaxing VR experiences. That's one of the neat things about it too. Is a lot of the people are messing around with VR and focusing less on the game elements and more on just some sort of an experience, mm-hmm. which is kind of neat. But we're all about the game stuff, personally.
Well, you can wonder, I mean, why. Interactions, right? Mm. There's like, you can't, like, I feel like there's a lot of backlash recently on games that when you are about all about exploration and interaction, right? Or the adventure game genre as not games. That's very upsetting to me because they tell great narratives and they use puzzles, and that's pretty much how it's done. And like games like Gone Home, people call that a non-game, or a walking simulator, or Stanley Parable.
Oh, Stanley's Parable, yeah.
As a non-game because it's just like a walking simulator. I'm like, no, those are still games. Because like their requirement of games is like there needs to be like a point system, there needs to be like some sort of end, there needs to be like a multiplayer element to it. I'm like, no, those aren't requirements for games. Is almost as general as art, as his definition.
Yep, and I think that's a really good topic right there, Ken. I mean, we've had discussions about that, just the two of us, numerous times. I'm more on the gameplay side of things. I grew up, you know, playing NES titles where our story was, you know, the princess is in another castle. That was our story. That was all we got. I pretty much focus exclusively on gameplay and view storytelling as, you know, the icing on the cake. But I think part of this is that misconception, as you say, Ken, that a lot of people see games more from the play side of things as opposed to the experience. And that's what games like The Stanley Parable, Gone Home, The Void, or even something like To the Moon go for. They're not aiming for, you know, super detailed gameplay. They're looking to tell a very unique story. And the problem is that it's very hard to put a price on a story compared to a game. But even then, as we were just talking about with mobile versus PC, putting price on gameplay is also its own, you know, complicated art form.
Yeah.
Aesthetics are important, too. I mean, not just storytelling, but just the general impression someone has. Because it doesn't matter if your game is super crazy fun. If the art and stuff and the presentation, the aesthetic is forgettable or atrocious, I don't want to continue playing your game. And a lot of people won't even pick up your game because of that. And, you know, there's some developers that I've seen that, like, say, screw that, I'm just going to do this really, really bad pixel art. And, you know, they don't really like it, and their games don't trend, and they don't know why. I'm like, listen, because it's all part of a package. You need to have a balance of both. You know, your mechanics create its own type of aesthetic, right? And your aesthetic needs to kind of match that too. So
if we took the art style that we're using for Upsilon Circuit, which is this kind of very 3D sort of cartoonish to some extent art style, but it's all very three-dimensional, really painted and interesting, and we put the Legend of Dungeon gameplay into it, it would look like it would just be a horror show.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things that lets us have this kind of weird hack and slashy sort of like our sword swing animations in Legend of Dungeon are literally two frames. You can't do that with a 3D model. You have to actually have your gameplay has to fit the art. If you up the art, you have to make sure that the gameplay still follows. And that's definitely a challenge for a lot of people.
Yep, and that really goes back to what we were saying at the beginning of the cast regarding games that have that unified style and aesthetic, and not many developers can really tie all that together. We brought up Don't Starve from Clay Entertainment, which is an excellent example of a game with art, gameplay, and music all unified to produce that one cohesive vision. Nintendo, of course, another great example. But yeah, it's one of those things that it's something that you generally don't think about, especially if you're coming purely from a design and gameplay point of view, you know, how the story's going to be, what kind of art you're going to use. Because a lot of people who do design may not necessarily have an art background and know what to do on that front.
Yeah. The other side of it, like what I was just saying, the other side of it is if you have amazing gameplay, but your art isn't up to par, if it's not cohesive, you're wasting the awesome gameplay that you have on a good percentage of the people, because humans are very fickle, I guess. it's a good, like, they want to look at something pretty, and if it's not attractive enough to them, it doesn't matter how good your gameplay is, it's just not pretty enough, so it's not worth their time.
Right. Again, if you like, I've actually had someone kind of argue this. Like, I had a student argue this with me. Like, their website was atrocious, like horrible. Like, if you used to look at the site, you would, your retention rate would be like less than a millisecond. It's that bad. And they're like, who cares about the website? It's, you know, it's all about the content inside of it. I'm like, yeah, but it's like you're delivering a package and a box full of poop. They're not even going to touch or look what's inside of it if they're disgusted with the packaging, you know, or like how it's being presented to them. Presentation yeah. matters just as much as the guts inside of it. By the way, his guts weren't very good either. But anyways, the point is, I think that people kind of forget that, you know, a big part of notoriety or getting yourself known or visibility is the way that you present your work. And if you're sloppy with it or you don't have enough attention to detail, you're gonna get hurt by that.
Yeah.
All right. So I think with that, we can move on to our final topic. Again, with VR and interactivity, we could spend the next hour or two on that topic. I know Ken is really hungry to do like a VR-specific cast at some point.
Definitely.
So with that said, let's move on to our final topic, Alex, and that is talking about your next game, Upsilon Circuit, or what you can talk about because it is a big secret. So I read your little introduction you had in the email about, and it sounds very interesting. So why don't you tell the folks listening at least, you know, the basic pitch of what Upsilon Circuit is?
Sure. It is part game show and part action RPG. It's an online game, but there's only a single server that's running at specific showtimes, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And that server only allows 8 players onto it. And basically the concept is you have contestants that are playing the game as these 8 players. And anytime they're in the server, when the show is on, air quotation marks, once again, they are live streaming out to the audience. So it's kind of two games intertwined. There's the contestants that adventure and the audience kind of intervenes and interacts. Mm-hmm. And one of the other things about it is that it is a perma-permadeath game. Legend of Dungeon is a roguelike and it has permadeath. So, you know, when you die, your run is over. But that wasn't hardcore enough for us. We decided we wanted to make a game where when you die, you never get to play again, ever. So you literally, if you get to play the game, you only have one shot. And it's a large overarching story, so you'd only be kind of taking, you would get a piece of that story. You would have a chance to make yourself, like, you could become a hero, you know? If you survive long enough, you could be well-known and renowned, and then when you die, people might still like you, you know? Who knows? And then one of the ideas for it is that there's going to be this overworld and these generated dungeons and secrets and more secrets that I can't say. And then there's the object of the game for the people who are playing the action RPG is they're actually on 2 separate teams of 4, and they're trying to collect these crystal shards that are strewn about the world. And that's all I can say about that. it's so tricky because the story is only going to happen once, which is not normal for a video game. Usually, you know, somebody plays and then they can kind of play again. In the World of Warcraft, everybody gets the same sort of storyline progression. But this is really starting at point A and ending at point B, and it doesn't go back to A ever again. Okay. So like your actions and how you affect the world permanently affect the world.
So when you say that only 8 people can play at a time, does that mean that, let's say I'm one of those 8 people and, you know, maybe I need to go eat dinner, so I sign off. Does that mean that someone else will take my spot until I get back? Or does that mean that the group will only have 7 people until I decide to pop back in?
Well, Upsilon Circuit is a little bit unorthodox in how it works in general, and so we're going to be kind of working things out a little bit more once the beta happens. Okay. But right now the idea is that we'll run the game, the servers will be up for 2 or 3 hours a day.
Okay.
So it would be kind of the sort of thing you might have to plan your life around a little bit. You'd have to bring your dinner to your desk or eat before or after. So we're trying, because we're trying not to ask too much of people. And the idea is that those 8 players would have priority the next day. So everybody could log in and it could be a continued thing.
But of course, when someone dies, then they're out. They're not going to be able to get back into it.
Right. They return to the audience, so they can still participate the way the audience can, but then a new audience member gets chosen and they get to play. So it's kind of like, The Price is Right, come on down, sort of. but as an audience member, because in a lot of ways, since there's only eight people ever playing at a time, we're trying to put a lot of effort into the audience experience. It's something that we think is really cool and you can do a lot with. So kind of they are, we kind of want to fashion them as dungeon master, strategist, and judge and jury. Because while you're live streaming, you can have your microphone on and people can not like you and send in bad things, or want to help you and send in good things, kind of like the Hunger Games
I
or
was just
Running
about to say that.
Man. Yes. So that's one of the things that you'll get to do as an audience member is you'll be earning these this currency and that you can then send into the game, as well as any player who kills monsters or earns experience points and other rewards. Those things actually go and are distributed to the audience, and the audience collects them and actually is the one in charge of the skill tree for that player. So that's the strategist part to some extent. And there's also a huge, like, puzzling story type thing, some other stuff that the audience is also involved in.
Now, in terms of like playing the game itself, is it going to technically be like free to play? Will there be like an initial cost to get into it?
I think, kind of think of this as if it's a television show. We realize that it is, in essence, impossible to have this game be something that we can ask money for, because if it becomes even remotely popular, the chances of you actually getting to play the action RPG game are so, like, barely possible. It's like winning the lottery if this game becomes really popular. And so we don't feel like it would be fair to ask money for it. And so it's kind of more like as if it was a television thing. We do plan to monetize it by allowing people to kind of customize their avatars. So there's like that kind of a thing. Team Fortress 2 hats. There you go.
League of Legends skin,
The
stuff like that.
expansion skin.
Perfect.
Right. Because if you do get selected, that's what you would get to look like inside of the game. And there's also going to be some social aspects happening inside the audience where people will be able to hopefully see like a little user icon that is what your character looks like, et cetera. So we're trying to do that. And I think there's some other elements of being able to change the game world and send things in, the Hunger Games element, which we may also monetize some of the things.
In terms of like content or keeping the game up, you said this is going to be a one-time deal. How long, or if you can say it, how long like are you like developing the game to last? Like, is it going to be like a few months, a year, something like that?
Yeah, our goal is for the game to run for about a year, but that depends on how quickly people burn through the content. But since it's happening over a course of 3 hours a day, it's still quite a bit. Like 3 hours times is like over 300 is a lot. That's a lot of hours of gameplay, and for such a small team, it's definitely a challenge.
Now, one thing I was wondering if you've thought about yet is, will the game be like available to play globally? Because, as you said, if it's going to be a single server with specific set times, that could run into some trouble with, international audiences. People who are like 5, 6 hours ahead of us.
Yes, that is unfortunately one of the things that we kind of have to just let it be. We have to pick a showtime and have that be the showtime. One of the other things is that this show is going to, I'll start from the beginning as far as this goes. We've decided that since not everybody is, professional live streamer personality type person and they might just want to play the game, we decided that we wanted to have some sort of a cohesive character inside of the game. And so we have this game show host. His name is Ronnie Ragon. And he actually kind of runs the show. And he will be speaking English and only English. So that is another limitation, is that the language is going to just be English.
All
So,
right.
since it's live, we can't exactly localize it.
Now, you said that the gameplay is going to be ARPG style. So is the game going to play like similar to something like Diablo or Path of Exile?
Yeah, to some extent. We've kind of drawn some inspiration from The Legend of Zelda, both the original and like Wind Waker and later. And definitely there's a little bit of a Diablo sort of feel to it. But it's also kind of got our, I don't know, it's because it's such a strange concept. And there's not really a genre for it. Mm-hmm. It was hard to sort of fit like inspirations into it almost. In a lot of ways, it grew out of the idea of having a game where people can only play once.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted a game that was fun to watch. That was our together portion of this. A lot of the inspiration for Epsilon Circuit is us wasting time watching people play Legend of Dungeon on Twitch. I've spent like 8 hours of a day watching people stream, so that was kind of one of the motivations, was a fun to watch game.
We need a VR stream for the game. I would love to watch that VR stream. I will sing its praises in the Oculus forums.
We shall see. There's a lot of technical issues and trickery that we have to do in order to make this even possible.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows if we can do VR anything in it. Yeah. If we can, we will, because Calvin's a massive VR. Like, that's his passion.
We should talk. We need to bring. we need to have you both back on. We'll have a VR discussion.
And it definitely sounds very interesting as a design. We normally don't see developers go for, like, one unique experience type deals. The only thing that comes to my mind was, like, the Pierre Moling Hero Curiosity thing with, like, hitting the cube and stuff like that.
Right.
Now, with Upsilon Circuit, as we said, it's going to be like a 2 to 3 hour cast per day. Does it work like you have to get there early to register? Or as you said, like, if you were already playing, do you get, like, priority? Like, you can show up at, like, the last minute, you'll automatically get put in?
To some extent, we sort of have to test all of that stuff. Uh-huh. Because, you know, in a sense, we're asking for a lot of commitment from somebody who's playing. Because we'd ideally, like, when you watch, like, a TV show like Survivor or something like that, you get kind of invested in the people who are in the show. And we'd like to maintain that. So we're going to try to make it as easy as possible for the people who have already played to come again the next day.
Okay.
So that's kind of one of the things that's almost a requirement. If you don't show up for a long enough period of time, you may lose your spot because we may have to replace you. Because the most important thing is the watcher's experience. You know, if there's only one person out of the original group that is still playing, it's not very fun to watch. You need those two teams in order for it to be interesting.
Okay. Now, when you're playing the game, is it always going to be set as an 8-character, 8-player maximum per night? Or, like, will sometimes there may only be 4 people playing or 6 people playing?
I think we'll have a minimum amount of people playing, and at that point, if the previous players haven't shown up, we would have someone from the audience join. We'll probably always have like a good portion of players on deck, so to speak.
Okay.
And in a lot of ways, it is kind of like running an actual TV show.
Mm-hmm.
So you need your contestants.
Yeah. Definitely sounds very fascinating to try and manage and all that.
Very ambitious.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of what we do. We have problems.
And I really look forward to it. I hope I can try and get on, but given my luck, either I'll last to the end or my first hour in, I'll die accidentally. I'll do something stupid and I'll never be allowed to play again.
Yep, it could happen, but people will be amused.
Mm-hmm.
You're sacrificing your life for the people's amusement.
Now, will you be able to record the plays and then, you know, watch it like at a future time of your leisure?
We're probably going to have reruns and that kind of thing. And so, yeah, it should be accessible to people afterwards as well.
Right.
The other thing is we're planning on having an intellectual level to this, too. Like, we want there to be puzzles and just challenges and things that would take more than just a single person to solve.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we want the entire audience, like, all the people who are watching who are into that kind of thing to be trying to, like, decode things and figure out little subtle back-end things. And it's going to, I would like to see, at least, I would like to see the result of the game, like, the end of the game change if they figure out everything.
Just like on like the game shows, you have like people screaming from the audience, "No, it's still alive! Get over there!" Now, I know this is probably way too far in the future to consider, but if Upsilon Saga does become a success, do you see you and your studio making like multiple seasons of this in the future if it does catch on?
Maybe. We've talked a little bit about other really interesting things that we could have as far as, I guess, online audience. There's no genre name for it, so I don't know, online audience games. Mm-hmm. One of them actually involves VR, so maybe we'll do that. But the truth is, this is going to be probably the most demanding game ever, because we will have to be there every single day, and everything is happening live, and we will have to make sure that the game is responsive and fun and interesting, and we want the lore of the game to be created as the game goes, which changes depending on how people play. So
Ken said the word ambitious a few minutes ago, and I agree with him there. I mean, if you guys can pull it off, it will definitely be an amazing thing to watch and interact with.
Well, hopefully we can.
I mean, what you talked about too, about like creating like history. Like, that's probably one of the best things about MMOs. Like, when you first, like, when big guilds, like, first take down the monster for the first time, like, the first on all the servers, like, that's, like, history being made. That's something.
But the thing about that is, yeah, you took down that monster first, but a whole bunch of people get to take it down afterwards.
I understand that, but I'm saying, you're invoking the same kind of feeling, which is why it's cool.
You would have somebody inside of Upsilon Circuit who defeated the Kraken, you know, whatever. It's like one person or one group of people did that, and nobody else gets to do that ever.
It's a one-shot daily. That's why it's so cool.
Yeah, I don't know if you can tell from my voice, but I get stupid excited.
No, I'm saying, like, you're invoking, for every action you're doing, you're invoking that feeling, which is awesome. And that's something that people are kind of craving for, because they hate that repetition or how things spawn again. And, you know, like, oh, maybe you did this epic quest, but then, like, thousands of people can also do it. And then it's not really that epic now, is it? So you're really creating that feeling of once and done, pretty much a replication of reality. So, good on you. Something unique, for sure.
Well, thank you.
And I guess one last question, then. I think this will be it for me. In terms of, like, difficulty and scaling, will the game be designed to become, harder for, like, that same group to, like, try to force new people in? Or are you thinking about just keeping, like, a general difficulty level and then basically letting the chips fall where they lie?
There's going to kind of be a little bit of both. We have things in mind that will definitely kill people. but we also, one of the things that we are trying to, actually, this is mostly my job, and I've been very slow about it because it's really tricky, is we're trying to make a skill tree that's very expansive, but also doesn't lead to a person being more powerful in a sense. Like, it creates a specialty and not so much like a, basically, if somebody just brand new to the game logs in and there's somebody who's been playing for like a whole month, like they've had an amazing streak and they're still there, they have all this experience and they're all leveled up, I want that person who's been playing for a long time to still be scared of this new player logging in, because that's something I left out. Anybody can kill anybody, even your own teammates. so there's a lot of interesting things that could come about from that as well. You're not just dealing with the monsters inside of the game, you're dealing with the other people that you're playing with.
Now, when you say that players can kill other players, is there going to be PvP, or are we just generally talking about like friendly fire from attacks?
I think the way we're currently planning on having it is that you automatically can damage anyone on the opposing team.
Okay.
And you have to press a button. Like, you have to be holding down a button on your controller or on your keyboard. I think controller is really the way to go, though. But, like, hold a button down so that you are in aggressive mode, and then you can kill any of your teammates as well.
Okay, so there's going to be two teams of players playing at the same time, then?
Yes, and they're not necessarily all going to be in the exact same spot. We're trying to make the world fairly large so that you can kind of just be, you know, I just want everyone to feel really insecure all the time, basically.
All right. And one thing I just thought of, like, when you're playing the game, now you said it's going to be like 2 to 3 hours of server access per day. Can someone, like, basically log off early, or do they have to commit to that block?
We're going to ask people to commit to that block, but at the same time, there's only so much that you can expect from people. And there will probably just be a few people who get to pop in to take over or something. We have a large handful of possible solutions for it, and we need to test them all out in the beta. It's one of the things that definitely has to happen because it's such an unusual thing. It's like, I don't know. Do you know how to do this? If you have any ideas, let me know.
If anyone can pull this off, it's you. All going back, Treehouse. Come on.
Yeah.
Treehouse. If you're willing to do all that, I think that your dedication will definitely shine through here in terms of taking, pulling all the stops and making all the big chances and stuff like that. So, yeah.
We have a really amazing team. I'm very confident that this will happen. I'm really, really glad that this is happening. So hopefully we can do it.
Cool. Now, I guess finally then, do you have a time for when you're going to actually put Upsilon Circuit up for people to try?
That is a difficult question because I don't know if you've talked to other devs, but there's this general theory that whatever deadline you set for yourself, the game will take 3 times longer. So the goal is to have something kind of in like a rough alpha playable state by like early this coming year.
Okay.
But we will see. Hopefully we'll have something that people can really get their hands on by the summer. That's my goal. If we get there or not is another story, but it's definitely something that we're aiming to have available in 2015.
Cool. Yeah, and definitely keep us aware because this is definitely going to be something I think we're both going to be interested in checking out.
Awesome. Yeah, I would love to try it. Watch Josh perish.
Yeah, send in all the bad monsters and things while he plays. I'm really expecting that to happen. Like when you play, you don't want to tell your friends. They're just going to try to kill you.
Yeah, they're going to do everything they can to stop you from playing. And then they'll record it, and then they'll watch it later. Go, hey, remember when you suck at this? Yeah, let's put it up for everyone to watch.
Yeah, I remember like Josh is pretty cool and collected when he plays multiplayer games. I like to see him panic and hear live streamed. Whatever I do, I want to make sure it's unexpected because he does analysis of game design and he's ready for a certain mechanic. So hopefully we can throw enough weird stuff at him that he just collapses under his own brain.
There you go.
Awesome.
All right. I think with that we can start to wrap things up. So, Ken, do you have any final questions for Alex?
I praise you for coming out of that treehouse and from moving on to VR stuff, or at least playing with it, which is pretty cool, because not many devs that we've talked to actually play around with the Oculus Rift. In fact, many of them dismiss it as just a thing that's there, but they're not really supportive of it. They're like, it's just something that's cool, but
it's
nothing
the
that important.
Future.
I know it's the future. There's two types of technologies that are coming. It's either going to be virtual reality. Well, actually, they can coexist. Virtual reality and augmented reality. Those are the two things we can discuss.
I like both.
Cast VR, Google Glass, Oculus Rift, Morpheus, Gear VR,
so
all those things.
Yes.
All the things. People call it a fad, but there wouldn't be investment in it if it was just a fad. It wouldn't be a $2 billion purchase. It was just a fad. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yep. When you do a VR thing, definitely let me know because I'll make sure Calvin is here to do the talk with you because that is like it is since childhood. He has been like super VR fan. So.
I should send you one of my demos because I'm actually working on because I just got the Leap like 2 days ago, working on a Leap demo where you stand in an elevator and you press buttons to go up and down floors. And as I said in a previous cast, because I was working with another system with it, your goal is to not look at people that come into the elevator, and you get more you get combo points as you stop looking or look around. As long as you don't look at them, you get more points.
Antisocial elevator man, I like it.
I know Sounds it's good. The game's called I just named the game. It's called Elevator Etiquette. So
nice.
Awesome. All right. With that said, we're going to wrap things up. Alex, it was definitely a pleasure talking to you tonight. I'm going to definitely be trying out Legend of Dungeon. And as I said, Upsilon Circuit sounds fascinating. I really hope that it does succeed for you guys.
Thank you.
Do you have any final thoughts or anything you want to add before we say goodbye?
Final thoughts. It's been wonderful. Thank you very much for having me. And to anybody listening, thank you for spending your time listening to this. This is very awesome of you to give me an hour plus of your time. And if you are at all interested in Robot Loves Kitty stuff, we're on Twitter, but at Robot Loves Kitty, or, you know, the internet, Robot Loves Kitty. Everything, just Robot Loves Kitty. You got it. Good. We're there.
Awesome.
I love kitties.
Yeah.
And Ken, it was great having you on, and it sounds like you found another VR fan to talk to.
It's fantastic. More the better, please. It's evolution.
Awesome. All right. So with that said, we're going to end the Perceptive podcast for this week. Thank you for tuning in. And as always, just some last minute things to discuss. First, if you would like to be an upcoming guest on a podcast or write a guest piece for the site, you can find all the information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. And to contribute to our ongoing Patreon campaign to help secure funding for Game Wisdom itself, you can find that information under the Patreon banner at the top of the front page. Thank you for tuning in to the Perceptive podcast. By the time you hear this, it should just about be New Year's, so have a great holiday and have a great New Year as well.